are listening to WWBC Coco, Merritt Island, 1510 AM, as well as W234BI Coco, Rockledge, 94.7 FM, W264AS, Rockledge, Melbourne, Pompeii, Indy Atlantic, Indian Harbor Beach, Satellite Beach, 100.7 FM, and W260CL, Coco, 99.9 FM.
Hello, Space and Treasure Coast. This is Sita Biggie on AM 1510 WWBC, FM 94.7, FM 99.9, and 100.7. We are also heard worldwide on the web at WWBC. Ellen,
yeah,
take 15, it away.
1510 WWBC. You just hit that on-demand button. You can listen to us anywhere in the world.
I know.
We have listeners
wonderful.
All over. Yeah, we have listeners all over from the UK, from the Middle East, from all
Canada.
Kinds of Canada, from China.
Ireland.
Yeah, got all kinds of folks.
So for our listeners who are just tuning in, every Monday, Ellen O'Neill and I sit down here with Paul, and Paul runs our board. Thank you for giving me a voice on radio, Paul. I appreciate it. And we heat up the airwaves with kitchen table topics facing us right here in Brevard County, as well as around our state, and yes, around our nation. We are really, really happy that you all are tuning in, because we have an action-packed lineup today. We have Jo Shim, who will be on the second segment, and she is the president of the League of Women Voters right here on the Space Coast. So welcome.
Thank you.
And thank a longtime friend of the show.
And we're going to be talking about all the amendments with Jo later on. But in a separate issue, we have my good friend, Carlos Guillermo Smith, who is on the phone. And he is joining us to talk a little bit, as he's going to be like a surrogate today. We're having a friendly conversation with Carlos about his campaign. He's running for re-election in State House District 49. And then we're going to talk a little bit about the Biden-Harris campaign, their goals, and what we can do as voters to pay attention, get the information, and make an informed choice on early voting or on election day. So, Carlos, welcome to Viewpoint with Sita and Friends.
Hey, Sita, thank you for having me. It's so good to be back on your show. It's been a minute since I was on your show to talk about the issues that matter, but I'm super excited to be here, and thank you for having me.
Well, for us, you and Anna Ishkamani are two voices in the Florida Democratic Party that I can't say enough about. You two inspire so many of us to think about things like healthcare and reproductive rights and equality and environmental protection and affordable housing and the things you fight for, and your Facebook messaging, and when we see you on the news, you inspire so many of us so that we do continue to fight. So thank you so much. So tell our listeners a little bit on Viewpoint with Sita and Friends. Tell us a little bit about yourself and how you got involved in politics enough to have the nerve to run for office and win a couple of times.
To have the nerve, to
yes.
have the audacity. Thank you for that question. Well, I represent House District 49 in the Florida House of Representatives, which is East Orange County. That is the East Orlando area that includes the main campus of UCF. So that's actually in the district that I represent, the Waterford Lakes, Rio Pinar kind of university area. And I was elected in 2016. Of course, as a member of the House of Representatives, we're each up for 2-year terms. And I'm running for re-election for my third 2-year term. And during the time that I've been in the legislature, I'm just really, really proud of the work that we've done and the number of things that we've been able to accomplish. You know, one of the most important values that, you know, kind of motivates me on a daily basis is really fighting for fairness and equality. And that has really helped keep me centered in our work, especially during COVID-19. In the last several months, we have heard, our legislative office, CETA, has heard from thousands of Floridians who were struggling to get help from our state unemployment program, which, as we all know, because we've seen and many have experienced it for themselves, this is an unemployment system that was designed to fail on purpose. And so what our office did is we jumped into action to help so many of these folks get their unemployment payments from the state that they deserve. We've been a voice for small businesses that have unfortunately just really been in a tough situation because of COVID-19 and have gotten very little help from the state. And so we have been holding leaders accountable in Tallahassee to make sure that they have the relief that they deserve, whether they're a small business or they're a struggling Floridian. And we've also been able to bring millions of dollars in state appropriations back to the community that I represent to not only help veterans, first responders, even survivors of the tragedy at Pulse Nightclub who were suffering from PTSD, but also we have made an incredible impact on boosting state funding for the arts. 480 not-for-profit arts and culture organizations around the state saw a substantial funding boost from the legislature in 2019 as a result of our work. But it doesn't end there. I could talk to you all day long about the long list of issues that we've advocated for: affordable housing, fair pay, earned sick time, pushing back on corporate welfare, cannabis reform, gun control. My goodness, the list goes on and on. But also, very quickly, you did ask how I got into politics.
Yeah, because I remember, you and I, we've known each other for years, and I remember when you first put your hat in the ring, and I knew it's challenging. So, yeah, tell us a little bit how that came about.
Well, I managed a men's warehouse store for 8 years before I got really engaged in the political process and in organizing and community organizing. It was in 2008 when then U.S. Senator Barack Obama was elected president that I really, really wanted to get more involved to, you know, help implement his progressive agenda, but I couldn't figure out how to do it as a manager of the men's warehouse. So I volunteered for every organization I could that was politically engaged, organizations that fought for our civil rights, like Equality Florida and the Human Rights Campaign. And before I knew it, I became a legislative aide in the Florida House of Representatives for two previous state representatives, actually. And then finally in 2015, I made the decision to run myself. That wasn't necessarily my plan, and it wasn't what I had envisioned for myself just a couple years earlier, but I really felt like leadership was lacking in Tallahassee. We needed more folks in the Capitol that would speak truth to power and hold leaders accountable. And so I threw my own hat in the ring, and the voters elected me in 2016 and reelected me in 2018. So I'm humbled to serve.
Well, you know what? You have so much energy, and it's all positive and it's all good. But I wanted to ask you, we're all, you know, watching what's going on with the campaigns. And then last night, we saw that bombshell report in the New York Times about President Trump just paying $750 in his federal income tax. And then, you know, I mean, it's jarring. It's mind-boggling. And it's very, it's overwhelming for people like us who watch every penny and pay our fair share. So What is your take on that? Because a lot of people are saying, well, he plays a businessman in the Oval Office better than he was one in the real life. So what's your take on that?
Well, this report, it's shocking just that 10 out of the last 15 years, Donald Trump has paid $0 in federal taxes. Can you believe that? I mean, he has managed to get away with not paying his fair share for years and years and years. And on top of that, what we have found out is that Donald Trump actually owes hundreds of millions of dollars in debt payments that are supposed to come due in the next few years. which begs the question, you know, when Donald Trump is in the White House, it begs the question, is he really worried and concerned about the finances of everyday Americans, or is he more concerned about the finances of himself and his family? And knowing how much money he owes in debt, hundreds of millions of dollars, as was reported in the New York Times, it also kind of makes you wonder, how is he going to pay those obligations? Is he going to rely on foreign entities, foreign leaders, foreign actors to help him with some of these debts? I mean, it kind of makes you wonder about what his many motivations are. And by the way, all of these questions, these legitimate questions about what his debts are, his obligations, what he's been doing with his assets and his resources, these are all legitimate questions, which is why it has been a tradition for generations that presidential candidates reveal their tax returns, which Donald Trump refused to do, the first presidential candidate and now president in modern history that has refused to.
And why is that so? Really, because, you know, when I ran in 2018 against Thad Altman, I had to send in my tax returns, and you had to send yours, and Anna, and everybody else. Uh-huh. So, I mean, and I remember when my campaign was over, we had a discrepancy like for $10 or something, and Ellen and myself, we had to come up with that receipt. I mean, they scrutinize everything, so I don't understand. I mean, I guess we'll have to have an accountant on the show to explain all that to us, but how does people get away with such stuff, you know?
Yeah, I mean, it's incredible what he's been able to get away with. And look, the reality is that every year, hardworking Americans, they scrimp and they save and they toil over paperwork to pay their federal income taxes. Donald Trump paid just $750 during one of the more recent years. I think it was 2016. Trump sees the world from Park Avenue. He looks out for the stock market. He looks out for his Wall Street buddies. But he also looks down on workers and the middle class. His message, by the way, other than just rejecting all of this as fake news, which is a pathetic response to a serious report that has exposed all of his various assets and his lack of paying federal taxes, his overall message is that, oh, well, I was able to avoid paying these federal taxes because I'm smart.
Yeah, because I took advantage of the loopholes. Well, and you know, that's the thing. We all know that.
The rest of us are idiots, right? The rest of the working class people who are paying their more than their fair share of federal taxes, including the working poor. So they're just idiots because they weren't able to hire a rich, wealthy accountant that was able to find all the loopholes that they could to avoid taxation. Excuse me?
Right. I know. Well, you know, a lot of us know that Joe Biden sees the world from the hometown of Scranton, Pennsylvania, and our president sees it differently because, you know, the two men are so far apart when it comes to real values. But
100%.
I mean, right now our country is at such a pace where the hatred and the division and the fear is just so real, and it's scary, and so many people are so anxious right now, especially. We all watched this past week where RBG passed away, Ruth Bader Ginsburg, and President Trump took that opportunity to appoint a third Supreme Court, a nominee, because she's not confirmed yet, right? And a lot of people are so worried about women's rights and the LGBTQ community and abortion rights and all that. What is your position on this upcoming the hearings?
Well, first of all, it's important to acknowledge again just how much Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg meant to the civil rights movement in this country, not just for women, for immigrants, for workers, for LGBTQ people. I mean, I literally would not have this wedding ring on my finger had it not been for her vote in the Supreme Court decision in 2015, Obergefell v. Hodges, that finally affirmed the freedom of same-sex couples to marry. I mean, when we find a successor for Justice Ginsburg, this successor is going to have a profound impact on every part of our lives and our future. So for voters, it's not about who's sitting on the court. It's about the issues that hang in the balance, things like health care, civil rights, clean air and water, you know, equal work for equal pay. Like I said, the rights of voters and immigrants and women and LGBTQ people. Never before in our nation's history has the Supreme Court justice, first of all, been nominated and installed while a presidential election is underway. While people are actually voting, Republicans want to ram through a Supreme Court nominee from Trump, which defies every precedent and every expectation of a nation where the people are sovereign and the rule of law reigns, you know. And we have to point out the obvious hypocrisy, which
I know Merrick Garland. I swear, everyone that I know was posting something about Judge Merrick Garland because of the hypocrisy of what we're seeing to push through this vote.
Mm-hmm. I mean, the hypocrisy is just—it's stunning, blatant, and it's all there. I mean, the receipts. We have so many receipts from this conversation. CSAP. You know, we have video of senators like Lindsey Graham going out there saying, literally spelling it out 4 years ago, saying that if Trump were president and in his final year after the primaries had already started, if a vacancy were on the Supreme Court, Lindsey Graham, his almost exact words were, hold the tape, I want you to hold me to it, that we should not be putting forward and considering a Supreme Court nominee. I mean, you can't make this stuff up.
I know. Ellen is shaking her head too, because never in the history of the Supreme Court have we nominated somebody during an election, like a month away from the election.
Yeah.
It's never happened.
Never happened.
Right?
There's no shame.
No,
right. There is no shame.
But why do you think so? Why it is so? But Carlos, why it is so emboldened? I mean, what has happened to the Republican Party, the wing of the party that actually were able to reason and listen and reach over to the other side in a thoughtful, calm manner and say, let's talk about this? I mean, I don't understand what's happening
right.
to our
right.
country, because that is what we are used to. I mean, but these last three and a half, 4 years, it's been different. It's almost like a cult.
Wild West.
It's almost like it's a cult. It's not a political party anymore, you know?
Well, and the unfortunate reality is that time and time again, Republicans are putting party before country. They're putting their own partisan agenda above and beyond even their own conservative values. You know, the hypocrisy here is just blatant, and they're shameless about it. You know, putting party over country when they, you know, just allowed for Donald Trump to violate so many constitutional norms over the last 3.5 years as president of the United States, the refusal to hold him accountable during the impeachment hearings. I mean, it's just stunning. Voters are ready for a change.
Well, all of us watched in horror, with COVID-19 and how the response from the White House was. But what do you think Joe Biden would have done differently from President Trump if he was in the White House during COVID-19?
Well, first of all, he wouldn't have disbanded and eliminated a pandemic task force, which is what President Trump did even before the pandemic unfolded. But we know that Joe Biden would have taken and is taking COVID-19 seriously. He would have listened to doctors and he would have believed in science, as opposed to what Trump is doing, which is calling coronavirus a hoax, a Democratic hoax, he's been saying that for months. He's refused to demonstrate any kind of leadership by wearing a mask, which we know is one of the single most important tools at our disposal to reducing transmission of COVID-19 is universal masking. And Trump has just flagrantly disregarded all of the recommendations from health experts, from the Centers for Disease Control. And at the point that we're in right now, Sita, it seems really obvious that Trump has completely given up on even trying to contain COVID-19. And what's been devastating for Florida specifically, because we have a wannabe mini Trump as governor, Ron DeSantis, we have him mimicking everything that Donald Trump is doing, and Floridians have paid a deadly price. 14,000 Floridians have now died from COVID-19, and just like Trump, Governor DeSantis has essentially given up on trying to contain COVID-19. He's out there saying we're no longer going to have any business regulations whatsoever to try to maintain social distancing and keep people safe from COVID-19. He's out there promoting some bizarre bill of rights for college students to
I know, party. And the college students are the same ones that are going to go home and give it to grandma and grandpa, you know? But here's the thing. What do you think? I mean, what is Joe Biden's plan to address the pandemic and reopen the economy? Because as you know, I mean, how many people, almost 3.5 million Floridians, have filed jobless claims since mid-March, and tens of thousands have been either laid off or indefinitely furloughed. So what would a President Biden do to address the economic changes that have taken place in our nation, in Florida?
Right. Well, the first thing he's going to do is he's going to tell us the truth, unlike Trump. And if the experts tell President Biden that the virus is deadly, that it easily spreads, which it does and is, you know, that's, he's going to listen to them and he's going to tell us the truth. And Joe Biden, only he has actually a plan to control the spread of the virus and reopen schools and our economy. That means calling on every American to wear a mask, testing and tracing, getting PPE to those who need it, and outlining clear steps for schools and businesses to reopen safely. And of course, he's already put forward plans to make sure that once we do emerge from the crisis, that we don't just go back to the way things were broken before the pandemic, but that we build back better, as he says, more resilient. He has led by example since the beginning of the crisis, and that is the kind of leader Joe Biden would be as president.
Well, thank you for saying that. And for our listeners who are tuning in, we're speaking with State Representative Carlos Guillermo Smith. We have about 5 minutes left in this segment. And Carlos, you know what? I just want to tell you, you know, I work primarily my 4 days a week in a nursing home, and I've never had to assist in brown bagging a body after a person died, right? And with COVID-19, we had to. Well, how would a President Biden protect seniors during this trying times? Because this one is near and dear to my heart. It really is. With so many seniors, I mean, close to 40% of the total deaths in Florida have been residents and staff at nursing homes and long-term care facilities. So what do you think our President Biden would have done differently?
Well, first of all, I think it's important to just say out loud, Sita, thank you. Thank you for being a frontline healthcare worker. And thanks to so many of the other frontline healthcare workers that have been in nursing homes, assisted living facilities, hospitals. You know, there's just been so many folks who have sacrificed so much, including their own personal health and safety, for the health and safety of others. So I just wanted to say that publicly. Thank you, Sita, for everything that you have done. But what's important to understand is that while, as you acknowledge, that senior communities have been devastated by COVID-19, 40% of the deaths in Florida have been residents at staff and nursing homes and long-term care facilities. We have to protect older and other high-risk Americans with testing, transparency, so that they can make informed decisions about isolation. And we're not going to, we can't indefinitely cut them off from loved ones, certainly, but it isn't just about those in long-term facilities. There's 4.7 million Floridians who rely on Social Security that Trump is already threatening to defund. About one in three older Floridians rely on Social Security as their only source of income. Eliminating the payroll tax, especially with no plan to replace the revenue, is effectively defunding Social Security. And Trump is threatening Social Security as part of his just incoherent response to the COVID-19 pandemic. This is one of the many reasons I'm supporting Biden. He wants to expand Social Security benefits that our seniors have earned, put it on a path to long-term financial solvency, providing higher benefits to the oldest Americans, implementing a true minimum benefit for lifelong workers, and protecting widows and widowers from steep cuts to their Social Security benefits. So this is a really important part of the conversation, Sita.
Thank you. We have 2 minutes left, and I wanted to ask you really quick, with the 2 minutes left, how do we express to the Hispanic community that the Hispanic vote will be critical in this election? Because some polling indicates that Joe Biden isn't where he needs to be. I have to say Joe Biden and Kamala Harris with the Hispanic voters. So in the remaining minute and a half, what can you tell us? What's the campaign strategy to win these voters over?
Well, it's continuing to reach out to the very, very diverse Hispanic population, certainly in the state of Florida. But what I think is important for voters to understand in Florida, and Hispanic voters especially, is there's a reason why both presidential candidates are courting the Hispanic vote in Florida. It's because they will ultimately decide who the next president of the United States will be. A lot of people are, you know, they're sometimes indifferent to voting. You know, they're jaded. They think their vote doesn't count and that there's no need for them to participate in an election. When in fact, the opposite is true, especially for Hispanic voters in Florida. We have 29 electoral votes in the state. And we are a winner-take-all state, which means that even though we're not a red state and we're not a blue state in Florida, we're somewhere in the middle. Because our statewide elections are always won by razor-thin margins, Sita, as we've seen in governor's races and presidential elections in the past, Hispanic voters literally will decide who the next president of the United States is. In Florida, they have a super vote. They have a super voice in this process. And I can't think of something with more poetic justice than to see specifically Puerto Rican voters, many of them who have the very first opportunity they've ever had to vote for president, because when they lived on the island, they were not allowed to vote for president of the United States. Hundreds of thousands of them have moved to Florida since Hurricane Maria and during the diaspora. I can't think of something with more poetic justice than for them to ultimately be the deciding factor
and get out the vote,
right? Trump, and what stays in office after all the insults, after him saying that 3,000 people didn't die after Hurricane Maria, after him leaving them dangling on the vine after Hurricane Maria, and the insult saying he wanted to trade Puerto Rico for Greenland, calling the island dirty and poor. I can't think of a more sweet poetic justice than for Puerto Ricans.
And what a great message to make sure that we end the segment on, right? Is to make sure that all of our Hispanic friends that are out there, we are going to take a quick break. Carlos, thank you so much for sharing all of your wisdom today.
Thank you for having me.
Yes, and Ellen will put your website on our Facebook page as well. Good luck, and you know what? We love you. Thank you for taking the time to call in and as a surrogate for the Biden-Harris campaign. I'll catch up with you later.
And we will be taking a very quick break here for Viewpoint with Sita and Friends. We'll be right back with Joe Shim with League of Women Voters right after these messages.
Families will love the Space Coast Symphony Orchestra's Music at the Watering Hole, a free online family concert. The program will feature a stimulating original story by national best-selling author Michelle Wallace Campanelli that will come to life on screen with a film presentation created and directed by award-winning Mendex Studios. King of Africa, Kojo the Lion, was surprised when a box fell off a tourist bus and dropped a symphony of musical instruments near his watering hole. With a great love for music, Kojo decides to bring all of the wild animals of the savannah together. Could these natural enemies learn to get along to become an orchestra? And just what would they play? The concert will feature music from Madagascar, Lion King, Zootopia, Jungle Book, Jurassic Park, The Croods, and more. So once again, that's Music at the Watering Hole, Sunday, November the 8th at 3 p.m. This is a SpaceCoastSymphony.org online event. Music at the Watering Hole, Sunday, November the 8th, 3 o'clock, SpaceCoastSymphony.org.
Welcome back, dear listeners. This is Sita Biggie on Viewpoint with Sita and Friends. Sometimes I don't like saying my name, but I do say it. We had a really great first segment. And
yes,
the
with
second
Carlos.
Segment?
Yeah, with, our second segment is with Joe Shim and with Alberta, right? Who's on the phone with us. And thank
well,
you so much for...
Well, she's going to be calling in.
Oh, she's going to be calling in. Okay. Well, I just wanted to tell our listeners a little bit about the League of Women Voters. The League is proud to be a nonpartisan, neither supporting nor opposing any candidates or political parties at any level of government. But they're always working on vital issues of concern to members and the public. So the League of Women Voters has always been a great resource for both of us, Sita, right? For finding out the issues, for finding out about the amendments, and really seeing it from just a factual, black and white, this is the situation. Vote the way your conscience is. It's not about partisan. It's not about party line or any of that. So we're just so happy to have Joe with us. Joe, you've been on the show quite a few times and representing right around, usually around election time, but for other times as
yes,
well.
Yes, we talked on many issues.
We have. That, yeah,
yes,
we have.
Yes,
so
yes.
Thank you so much for joining us.
Oh, it's good.
Today.
Great to be here. And I just wanted to stress that the League of Women Voters is all about getting people to engage in government and to be educated and to advocate. And, you know, there's lots of things on our ballot that we have to be educated about. So I hope we're going to get a little bit of an opportunity to talk about that and just to give people ways that they can get information that they need to be a responsible voter.
And the paper that you brought, Sita and I, this 2020 Nonpartisan Voter Guide, where can people pick this up? And I'll make sure I take a picture and send it out to our
okay,
Facebook friends.
So it's actually, we had 5,000 copies for the whole of Brevard. We know they're going to be in big demand. Most of them are being distributed through the library system. So go to your library. They went out last week. And if you aren't lucky enough to get a paper copy, you can go to the League of Women Voters of Florida website as lwvfl.org, and you can get information on all the amendments. The voter guide is just on the amendments this time, but you can get information electronically at the League of Women Voters of Florida website. So we
right.
hope that everybody will be informed before they vote on those issues.
And that seems to be a question that almost every single voter have when they fill out their ballot, because people don't read enough, read up enough about the amendments. And I just want to stress to our listeners who are tuning into Viewpoint with Sita and Friends and those who would be listening to the podcast later, some of the issues that will directly affect you and your family members, and one of the reasons why the Nonpartisan League of Women Voters, which Joe Shim is the president of in Brevard County, Florida, are things like voter and civic education, ethics in county government, healthcare reform, environmental issues, government, including fair districting, taxation, we just talked about taxes, mm-hmm. and voting rights. And these are topics that really and truly or every single person should be worried and informed, right, about.
Yes.
So let's start talking about these amendments. There's six of them, and one of them is to raise the minimum wage. We've sat in this studio, Ellen, for months upon months and years upon years, and often wonder, how can someone survive by making minimum wage? People have to put gas in their car. They have to pay rent or mortgage. They have to buy food, clothes, utilities, pay a phone bill. Not everyone was born with a golden spoon in the mouth or had a daddy or mommy to leave millions of dollars or even a few $100 when they leave the planet. So people cannot survive. We know this because we see what's happening with the gap with Medicaid, and Joe and I have talked about that.
Yes. Well, the rising cost of housing and
healthcare,
everything.
So Joe, tell us a little bit about the amendment, that's Amendment 2, to raise Florida's minimum wage.
So the amendment, just briefly, will say, says that starting on September the 30th next year, the minimum wage will be raised from $8.56 an hour, which it currently is, to $10. And then wages would then increase annually by $1 an hour on September the 30th until it reaches $15 on September the 30th of each year. So that would be an annual raise up to 2026, then it would be $15. And later, then the increases would be pegged to the annual rate of inflation.
Right. So who is against this? Because, I mean, we all know people who would like to have more money in their paycheck, who would like to have more money so that they could actually live and survive on this planet. Who is for Amendment 2 to raise minimum wage, and
so
who's against it?
I think I'd like to approach it more from what a yes vote and what a no vote would mean.
Yes.
I think that would be helpful.
Yes.
So a yes vote would mean it would raise the income for minimum wage workers above the poverty level over time. It would help to reduce race and gender income inequality. It would potentially increase economic activity because everybody would have a little bit more money. And it would require small and large business owners to budget for increased pay. And it would, we think it would have, the people who are voting for a yes vote think it would have no detrimental effect on job growth. Now, for a no vote, it means that it would allow businesses to keep low labor costs at current levels, avoid potential labor costs impact on the price of consumer goods, and maintain low-paying positions for teenagers and young adults joining the labor market. And it would likely continue a wage structure that can lead to poverty among young workers and women and minorities.
Right. So it seems as though if this amendment passes, the low-income workers would have more money.
Yes.
And it looks to me as though this amendment appeals to people who might turn out for Joe Biden, because they're saying that people, liberal voters, they can turn out in droves for this amendment because they'd like to have more money in their paychecks. Now, the opponents of this bill, of this amendment, they're arguing that raising the minimum wage will result in hours being cut and less hiring. They also say that higher labor costs will be passed on to the consumers through higher prices. So I think everybody needs to look at their own lives and why people want to see this minimum wage raised to $15 an hour. It's not going to happen next year. It's over time.
I think that's
what people are not getting, is that it's not going to happen right away. It's going to happen over time.
I think that's why it's well written, and it's going to be gradual, so it won't put too much pressure on businesses.
Right. So I think Alberta Wilson is calling in on the phone. She's going to be joining us in a minute. So how do we get more information on Amendment 2? I mean, how would you approach a lay person who is saying, well, listen, I own a business, and if the minimum wage is increased, then I would have to cut the hours for my... How do we approach that to tell people what Amendment 2 is about in lay terms?
Well, I would say for a business, just really stress that it's going to be, it's not going to be a one-time raise. It's going to be slow over time, so they'll be able to absorb it. And they'll also be able to keep their employers employed. That'll be less training costs, for instance, and they won't have the additional costs of hiring because they'll be able to keep their employers on working for their business. And I would also take this opportunity to stress that it's good to look at what the League of Women Voters has, but I would stress, you know, go to the Chamber of Commerce, see what they say about the amendments. Go to ACLU, go to their website and get a variety of opinions so that you can make an informed choice.
Alberta Wilson, are you on the phone with us? Alberta? Hello?
I'm on the phone.
Oh, hi, Alberta. So for our listeners who are tuning in to Viewpoint with Sita and Friends, we have Joe Shim, who is the president of the Space Goes League of Women Voters with us. Ellen O'Neill is with us as well, and Alberta Wilson. So Alberta, can you just tell our listeners quickly a little bit about yourself before we have you jump into the conversation about Amendment 2?
Sure. I am the founder and president of the National Congress of Black Women, and among other things, I am actively involved in the community, as most of you may know. And right now, I've got I'm up to my eyebrows in getting people registered to vote in preparation for November the 3rd, Election Day.
Well, thank you for taking the time to call in. I know all of us have been following what's happening with the amendments. Especially, I know I've been watching what's happening with Amendment 4 and Desmond Meade, and that's a whole show by itself. Mm-hmm. But anyway, so what do you think about Amendment 2, where we're trying to get this amendment on the ballot and have it passed to raise the minimum wage from $8.56 an hour to $15 over a period of time?
Okay, the minimum wage... What do I think about? Listen, that is way overdue, way past due. We wholeheartedly support any efforts to get the minimum wage raised. It's long overdue. So we're actively involved in trying to get that passed so that that will go into effect.
I know. I mean, I don't understand how anyone could actually raise a family or even themselves on that. But anyway, so let's jump into Amendment 3. Amendment 3 says that all voters vote in primary elections for state legislature, governor, and cabinet. So, Joe, tell us the pros and cons of that, or the do's and don'ts, or however you want to word it. What is the league's position on that?
Okay, so for Amendment 3, which is for open primaries, it would help increase voter party. A yes vote would mean that we would be able to include the 3.4 million of Florida's voters that are currently no party affiliation and currently don't get to vote in any primary. But it would potentially lead to fewer minority candidates, and it could also lead to two candidates of the same political party running against each other on the same race in the general election. The other thing to remember about this particular open primary amendment is that it would only apply to the Florida House and Senate. So you would be having a different system for the congressional race and the presidential race, and also for local races. Those would go back to closed primaries. So it's a bit of a mishmash.
It's a little bit of a confusion.
Yes.
But
I need to tell you what a no vote means.
Right.
So a no vote means continue the current closed primary election process, primarily maintaining two-party control over state government, retain voters' current ability to elect candidates that more closely reflect and represent the racial makeup of the legislative districts, and ensure nominated candidates conform more closely and consistently with the positions held by the two major political parties. So we would just be going back to the same system that we know, but we would
that
not...
That we understand right now.
Yes.
But a lot of the opponents of this Amendment 3 says it will also suppress the black representation
yes,
in the legislature
very important,
by opening up primaries.
Yeah.
So, Alberta, do you have anything to add to Amendment 3?
Yes, the one thing I'd like to say, it not only will oppress the black vote, it oppresses everybody's vote. People are quick to say, you know, it'll oppress the black vote. Of course it would, but it would oppress everybody else's as well. Initially, when I looked at this, I thought, wow, this is good, an open primary. Florida needs an open primary. We need an open primary like the hole in our heads. No way. Vote no on that amendment.
Well, you know, the Florida Republican and Democratic Party, for some reason, both parties are united against this one. And they argue the amendment is misleading because it doesn't open primaries, but effectively abolishes them by pitting the candidates from the opposing party against each other. That's one we're all going to have to read up about.
Yes, yeah? Definitely.
And that's why it's nice that Joe Shim is here, because a lot of people are going to be looking at these amendments on the ballot and be like, what are we going to do? We have to scratch our heads with it.
Well, and the point is not many people do a whole lot of homework prior to.
That's
so
what
they show up,
yes.
and they're reading these things. And much like any test that I've ever taken that's been for some type of certification, these ballots and these amendments are written sometimes in double negatives. And you really have to decipher what exactly is being said, which is why this paper is so helpful. What a no vote means, what a yes vote means.
That's right. And I like how Alberta said, that's a no for her.
Yeah, exactly.
So here's the other one. Amendment 4, voter approval of constitutional amendments. So let's talk about that one, Joe, and then we'll have Alberta jump in
so
on that one.
So we are actually calling this amendment number 4 to differentiate it from amendment 4, which you remember 2 years ago, we voted on to enable returning citizens, ex-felons, to be able to get back their right to vote. So we don't want people confusing them. So this one, amendment number 4, this is about getting amendment to the Constitution on the ballot. And this would mean that if you had, you know how most citizens' initiatives, you have to go out and you have to get petitions, and you have to get almost a million signed, and then you have to get it approved by the Supreme Court to get it on the ballot. And this says that even if you did that and you got it on the ballot and you passed with 60% of the vote, before it goes into the Constitution, it would have to go through another election cycle and also get 60% of the vote. And a lot of things have been done recently to put barriers in the way of getting petitions or getting amendments to the Constitution onto the ballot. And this would just make it almost impossible and
expensive.
And very expensive.
I mean,
it's expensive enough.
That's a no-brainer, that one. That's, we don't want that one.
This is why, this is why we have to work to defeat amendment number 4.
Yes,
that's
we
a
do.
No for me. A big
this
fat
is a
no.
No, with a capital N.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know who comes up with these things, but it seems to me they're saying that supporters of the Florida ballot initiative, this one for amendment 4, it's like Florida Power and Lights and the Sugar Corporation.
So this one, there's only one. The initiator was actually an organization called Keep Our Constitution Clean. They were the sponsors, and actually they're the only supporters.
For
amendment number 4, yes.
I read somewhere where it was linked to Florida Power and Lights and the
Maybe
U.S. Sugar
that,
Corp and
yes.
other big businesses.
Maybe that organization
that
is.
Yeah. I mean, and that's not a no-no. Anytime that Sugar Corp is involved in something, I smell a rat.
Exactly.
A stinky rat.
Exactly.
So, I mean, I don't know. I mean, it's always like people want to use their money and their power to lobby for something so they could always stay in control of whatever is happening. And that's just plain wrong. So amendment
it
4.
It is wrong.
Yes, yes.
See, that's one of the reasons. And I plan to talk to more organizational heads to see if we can come together and work diligently in the next 2 weeks at least to get the word out to the community on these amendments and our recommendations on how to vote for these amendments, because many people, they don't know, and they're not going to do, and if I'm talking funny, it's because I just had some dental work.
Yeah, we can't see it.
But anyway, yeah, they're not going to do the homework. So it's incumbent upon us to get the word out to all of the representative organizations for which we are affiliated.
Right. I mean, you know, here, so let's talk about Amendment 1 now. Amendment 1, I mean, they want to change one word. I mean, what Joe,
there
explain
is no,
that one.
There
to
is
us.
Really no value to that.
I mean, who thought about that one?
That would be very expensive to do, I think.
Alberta,
because you've got to go through every document and change it.
Yeah. Who came up with that one, Alberta, for Amendment 1? They want
to. I have no idea. And last night, before I went to bed, I finally got some time after Saturday. We had a big to-do Saturday, Joe and I, at the church with our voter registration.
It was very good.
And we had a successful day.
Yeah.
And I finally got to spend some time on this. And I'm going to defer to Joe on Amendment 1. This is crazy.
Yeah, they want to change one word. Who in their right mind would spend all this money? I think that one does not make any sense at all, Joe. So tell us a little bit about Amendment 1.
It doesn't. So I don't really know the reason why, anybody really wants to have it changed. And from the League point of view, a no vote would leave the constitutional wording as is stated. Every United States citizen who is at least 18 years of age and who is a permanent resident of the state, if registered as provided by law, can vote. So every citizen, you know, would stay in place. Only doesn't really make that much difference.
Yeah, that one again, I mean, I don't know who came up with that, but I'm sure money is behind it somewhere, somehow.
Oh, sure, yeah.
Or maybe it's a political tool and a ploy to say, we're patriots and we love the Constitution and we want to see everybody voting. It's always some nonsense like that, right? But we can see through that. Well, how about Amendment 5? And that's limitation on homestead assessments. Well, everybody knows that's about taxes. Right, Joe?
Right. So
something that President Trump better be listening right now to us about.
So the League actually opposes these because we think that these are sort of basically local issues. And, you know, we like to abide by home rule. But Amendment 5 is a limitation on the homestead exemption, and it would increase from 2 years to 3 years the period of time homeowners have to transfer their Save Our Home benefit from a prior home to a new home. So it just really gives anybody who sold a house more time to transfer that benefit to make sure that they actually get it. So a yes vote would help homeowners who sell their homes late in the year by allowing more time to transfer their SOH benefit to a new home. It would reduce property tax revenue available for funding local schools and other services like police, fire, and infrastructure, and limit the ability of local governments to control their budgets based on their county needs. And a no vote maintains the current Save Our Homes exemption of a two-year portability period which begins January 1 of each calendar year, effectively reducing the amount of time to as little as 1 year and a few days that a late-year homeowner seller has to buy a new home and transfer their SOH discount. So it just allows a little bit more time, but it potentially for counties and cities would affect property taxes that they are dependent on to run our schools, roads,
exactly.
Right, and the supporters of that is a Florida legislature. Oh, no, I'm not surprised.
So I would point out that the last two...
Immediately when I saw that.
Yeah, so tell us what you think about that one, Alberta, because that affects communities, children, parents, mm-hmm. I mean, everything.
Well, we, and I think I'm speaking for a number of people thus far, We adamantly oppose this.
Yeah, anytime it's less money coming into our communities, we oppose.
Yes, exactly.
So we have 3 minutes left, and we're going to talk a little bit about Amendment 6. That's a bit of a confusing one with the veterans and the permanent combat-related disabilities. Joe, let's hear your take on that
one. Okay, so just a brief summary. It allows a homestead property tax discount to carry over to the surviving spouse of a deceased veteran with permanent combat-related disability. This discount would take effect... It would take effect in January 2021 and remain in effect until the spouse remarries, sells, or disposes of property except under certain conditions. So a yes vote extends the additional tax relief to surviving spouses of a deceased veteran, reduces property tax revenue available for funding local schools and other services like police, fire, and infrastructure, add tax law to the Florida Constitution, making it difficult to alter in response to changing or emergency economic conditions. And that is one of the League's objection, that taxes shouldn't actually be part of the Constitution. So a no vote on Amendment 6 would continue the policy of discontinuing additional property tax relief for surviving spouses of deceased veterans who are permanently disabled by combat-related injuries. Not impact current levels of property tax revenue available for funding schools and other services, etc.
And again, with the 1 minute left, the supporters is the Florida legislature. We got that one straightened out right there. And the League of Women Voters opposes it. Alberta, what do you think about Amendment 6?
Okay, I personally agree with the League of Women Voters. We collectively, a group of community leaders meet on Thursday morning to make a final decision on Amendment 6, but as we stand today, the majority of us, we are leaning for a no vote. Unless that changes on Thursday morning, we meet at 10 o'clock in the morning right now, because it's quite confusing initially, as is a lot of these. You got to really read it and study it.
Mm-hmm.
But we got somebody who is near to the subject matter in Tallahassee, and they owe me a call back.
Alberta, unfortunately, the segment has ended. We are about ready
to
finish.
We have to bring Alberta back on.
Yes, we do.
Yeah.
But we want to make sure that everybody knows about the League of Women Voters. You can get this information online. Joe Shim is the president of the League of Women Voters. Alberta Wilson, thank you so much for joining us today and sharing your insight. Another wonderful episode of Viewpoint with Sita and friends Sita. Thank you for sharing all of this knowledge and information. And we'll see you next week right here live on AM 1510 WWBC.
I feel like I went to school just now.
The preceding program may not necessarily reflect the views of the staff or management of WWBC.